Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a giant announcement tonight on Afghanistan. The echoes of history will be in the hall as President Obama speaks at West Point. Here's John F. Kennedy, 1962, on Vietnam.
We are assisting in every way we properly can the people of South Vietnam who, with the greatest courage and with under danger, are attempting to maintain their freedom.
And LBJ, 3 years later, on Vietnam again.
To leave Vietnam to its fate would shake the confidence of all these people in the value of an American commitment.
And Barack Obama in the run-up to tonight's announcement on Al-Qaeda and Afghanistan.
We are going to dismantle and degrade their capabilities and ultimately dismantle and destroy their networks. And Afghanistan's stability is important to that process.
This hour, On Point, we'll look at presidents and war and the road to President Obama's announcement tonight on Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. What happens when a president sits down to decide on war? What have you made of President Obama's long deliberation on Afghanistan? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be joined in just a moment by Gordon Goldstein and David Ignatius. But first, joining us from Washington is Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC News. Jake, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
So 8 p.m. Eastern tonight, the president will lay it all out for the country. He's been talking with people all over the world. What is known, basic outline at this point, Jake, of what he's going to announce to Americans tonight?
Well, the way that the White House discusses this is that the president has, in many ways, forged a consensus with all the different voices around that war council table. And just in one teleconference that the president had on Sunday night at 6 p.m., he talked to two people who had very different points of view. The commander on the ground there in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, and the ambassador, the top diplomat, former General Carl Eikenberry. McChrystal, of course, pushing for anywhere from 40 to 80,000 more U.S. troops, and Eikenberry sending classified cables to the president, expressing concern about sending any more troops with Karzai in charge. And what the White House says is that they are on the same page now, that this new strategy the president's going to announce this evening with roughly 30,000 new U.S. troops, hopefully, as far as the president's concerned, 5 to 10,000 troops from allies, from NATO countries, will focus on rooting out terrorists, on training Afghan security forces, and we'll have some tough strings attached for President Karzai. The message that I got from a senior administration official yesterday was the era of the blank check for Karzai is over. A lot of the money and resources are going to be directed specifically at ministries that the U.S. government thinks are functioning properly, and specifically at governments on the local, district, and province level, and not directly to Karzai.
Jake, what about a timeline? President Obama has said he will finish this job. Will there be talk of a time to see American troops out of, or perhaps just the surge in troops, either of them, out of Afghanistan?
Well, the surge, we're told, the surge of troops is going to be, originally they were talking about it would take about a year to get 30,000 troops into Afghanistan because the terrain is so difficult. But now we're told that President Obama has pushed for much more rapid deployment. So it would take maybe 6 months for all these boots to get on the ground, as they say. As for an exit strategy, that is a big part of the speech that is right now unknown, that they're being very tight-lipped about. We're told that we will be briefed later today, those of us who cover this, on the exit strategy timeline for these troops to get in and then get out. But we're told that that is a big part of the speech tonight and a big part of the strategy, that the troops will be in there for a short period of time, relatively, with a narrowly defined mission to protect population centers and get the Afghan troops up and ready, and then U.S. troops would go home.
And paying for this further depth of engagement in Afghanistan?
That's a good question. We don't know about that right now, and there hasn't been a lot of discussion about it, and I'm not sure the president's even going to really talk about that tonight, even though he, of course, has been very critical in the past of President Bush's reluctance to budget the wars in the normal budget process, so the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, even though, of course, they haven't exactly been surprises every year that we've had to spend tens of billions of dollars. There's been a lot of talk in Congress about among Democrats about a war tax to help pay for this. We know it's about $1 million per year per service member, new service member that's being deployed. So if it's 30,000, that's about $30 billion a year more. I don't know right now where that money's coming from. I don't know that the president knows either. We pressed Robert Gibbs on this yesterday at the briefing, and there was, is he interested in talking about a war tax? Is he interested about some other funding mechanism? And we really did not get much of an answer.
Details that will be there, details that may not be there in the president's speech to the nation tonight from West Point. Jake Tapper with ABC News, White House correspondent there. Jake, thank you very much for joining us.
Anytime, Tom. Thank you.
Joining us now from New York City is Gordon Goldstein. He's author of Lessons in Disaster, McGeorge Bundy, and The Path to War in Vietnam. President Obama, Vice President Biden, and many others at the White House have been reading Gordon's book as they've considered the administration's momentous next moves in Afghanistan. Gordon Goldstein, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
Also with us from Washington, David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post, where he covers global politics, economics, international affairs, twice weekly column there. His latest book is novel, is The Increment. David Ignatius, always great to have you as well.
Hi, Tom.
So, Gordon Goldstein, they read your book, and you see the broad outlines of what's coming. What do you make?
Indeed.
What do you make of how your advice went down? Does it look as though it's been followed? We hear the president has forged a consensus. Is that the ideal path you drew from the stories of JFK and LBJ wading into Vietnam?
Well, we should come back to the question about how real this consensus is. Sometimes when presidents are at the precipice of a decision, they like to depict a consensus among their advisors when, in fact, does not exist. Kennedy was expert at doing this. And one of the aspects of this whole process by which President Obama has convened his war council is very Kennedy-esque in this sense. One of the lessons from Kennedy's era and how he managed the crisis in Vietnam is the following. And I sketch it in my book. Counselors advise, but presidents decide. Kennedy confronted a series of challenges in his first year in office. The first was the Bay of Pigs, and that was a great humiliation to him, and it instilled in Kennedy a deep skepticism about military plans. And after that, he was determined to never be, in his words, overawed by the advice he got from his military. So he instituted a new process of evaluating these decisions in which he was extremely probing and skeptical and methodical. And the way he encountered Vietnam was to appropriate that decision and decide he would not send in the first ground combat forces into South Vietnam, as was urged by his advisors. What President Obama has done is a process in these 10 or so meetings of his war cabinet to look at the decision very methodically, like Kennedy. The outcome, however, is very Johnsonian, very much like Kennedy's successor Johnson, in that he is, in essence, accepting and embracing the diagnosis of his commander on the ground, in this case General McChrystal, and the strategy that has been proposed, in this case counterinsurgency.
David Ignatius, is that your interpretation? Is President Obama, after all these weeks of consideration, debate, contemplation, giving General McChrystal what he asked for, what he warned the effort could not do without?
He's giving him almost as many troops as he requested. The General McChrystal's mid-range request was for 40,000, and the president will probably recommend 30,000. But he's going to send them in more quickly than McChrystal initially had proposed or had thought was feasible. The additional 40,000 were going to take roughly a year to be deployed. And from what we hear, this will now be speeded up. So it's a six-month insertion of the troops. And I think it's safe to say that they'll also be targeted to come out more quickly than McChrystal would have liked. I think essentially what Obama has decided to do is accelerate this process and try to test McChrystal's strategy in two key areas of Afghanistan, the area in Helmand Province, which is in the kind of south center of the country.
Poppy country,
the
opium
area
country.
Kandahar, which is south along the Pakistan border, where there already are substantial additional troops, but not enough, it's argued, to really secure these population centers. And as it's been explained to me by White House officials, the idea is to have a proof of concept that let's see if what McChrystal is proposing will work. Let's test it more quickly than was initially planned, and let's give ourselves the freedom. If it's not working, if it really doesn't work on the ground, to get out. If it is working, I'm told people will review this again next year and think, do we want more, do we want less? But I think the idea is to have a test of the strategy and have it more quickly.
Gordon Goldstein, we just have half a minute before the break. A test of strategy, however, puts those boots on the ground, and we know from history once they're there, removal is difficult in itself, fraught.
Absolutely. When President Johnson entertained the proposals from William Westmoreland in the summer of 1965 to go to 44 battalions, he thought that was a major increment and that he would stay there for a long duration of time. That proved not to be the case.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about presidents and war and the road to President Obama's announcement tonight on Afghanistan. David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post, is with us not long back from Afghanistan and Pakistan himself. Gordon Goldstein is here, author of the book Lessons in Disaster, McGeorge Bundy and the Path to War in Vietnam, widely read in the White House and around it over the late summer into the fall as the Obama team looked at Afghanistan. David, Gordon, let's listen to a couple of pieces of tape. Think about how Kennedy and Obama may be speaking dialectically with one another here or not. Here's a White House news conference, November 24th, and President Obama is saying the U.S. would forge a new course of action in Afghanistan.
After 8 years, some of those years in which we did not have, I think, either the resources or the strategy to get the job done, it is my intention to finish the job.
His intention to finish the job. And here's President John F. Kennedy talking with Walter Cronkite in September of 1963 with his now famous statement about the limits of America's role in Vietnam.
I don't think that unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it. We can help them. We can give them equipment. We can send our men out there as advisors, but they have to win it, the people of Vietnam, against the communists.
JFK, 1963, just weeks before his death. Gordon Goldstein, what do you make of the kind of dialectic across time and history here between that perspective from JFK and Barack Obama, President Obama? It's my job to finish this.
Well, the quote you have from Kennedy is exactly on point. It captures his determination to maintain a limit on the American commitment in South Vietnam. Kennedy did not believe that we could prevail in a ground combat war in which this contest would be fought by American forces. Therefore, his strategy was oriented explicitly toward training and reinforcing the South Vietnamese army and building up their capacity. He maintained that through the duration of his presidency, and that quote you have a month before the assassination summarizes it quite effectively. In contrast, President Obama seems to have embraced the sense of urgency communicated to him by General McChrystal in his assessment of August 30th, that we have now all read, thanks to Bob Woodward and the Washington Post and the wonders of the Internet. That argument that General McChrystal has made says that if we don't take urgent action, we will lose Afghanistan within a year. What President Obama has done is to accept this basic prescription of the urgency and to accept the strategy proposed here, which will be heavily oriented around classic counterinsurgency and population protection, as David Ignatius noted, in the South, in Helmand and Kandahar provinces. And it would be a strategy that President Kennedy would have eschewed in his era, but it's something that President Johnson embraced beginning in 1965 and the years that followed.
David Ignatius, what do you make of these weeks of process, the repeated meetings in the Situation Room that we saw, reports of quite polar perspectives on what ought to happen there, McChrystal and Eikenberry and others on the president's cabinet and team? Out of all that, is this a political calculation? Do you see a strategic calculation? Do you see Obama bowing to his Pentagon colleagues here? What do you interpret? How do you interpret the process and then the path to the outcome here, David?
The process certainly has been shaped by politics and by the big strategic issues. What strikes me about it is that you sense that the president really has been anguished by this decision, that not for no reason has he been reading Gordon's book and thinking about this really painful story of the Vietnam decision-making. If you look back a year, President Obama, during the campaign as a candidate, spoke about Afghanistan as the good war, contrasting it with Iraq, mm-hmm. the mistaken war. And this was the war that he was going to fight correctly, wisely, the one where we really needed to make a stronger commitment, he kept saying. And when he came into office, came into the White House, he embarked upon an initial review of policy. There were three separate policy reports that had been left behind by the Bush White House. He commissioned a fourth, headed by a respected former CIA officer, Bruce Rydell. And in March, that strategy was issued, and it called for a kind of dual mission of suppressing al-Qaeda sanctuaries in Afghanistan and also reversing the momentum of the Taliban in that country. Mm. And from March on, those two goals were really in conflict. I wrote a number of times that this was a strategy that was leaning in two directions at once. And by the summer, that really caught up with the president. He had a vice president, Joe Biden, who, with his eye on Vietnam and the lessons of Vietnam, mm-hmm. kept telling him in the White House, "Mr. President, we're making a mistake here. This is not a wise course. We're overextended." Meanwhile, you had the military, which thought it had been already given the strategy and was just asked to figure out how to implement it. So the McChrystal report that Gordon referred to before really was the implementation document, they thought. And where the White House, Biden and Obama were looking toward the Vietnam historical lesson, the generals were looking toward the Iraq historical lesson, just 2 years old, but they were looking at the effect that the surge of troops had in Iraq and, in fact, reversing the momentum, the downward slide there. So I think that produced the tension that we've been watching. And I've just sensed a president really troubled by this decision. In the end, he's decided to suck it up, as the military would say, and go to West Point and deliver what's going to be a policy of escalation, military escalation, mm-hmm. more rapid even than was requested. But a lot of anguish went into it.
Gordon Goldstein, how do you see this then? If the process was Kennedy-esque and the outcome or decision was Johnsonian, what do you think went on in the mind of this president to make that final leap? Do you see in this process what a consideration that came to a logical conclusion that he couldn't avoid? Or is this accommodating politics, pressure from the Pentagon? How do you look at it?
The way I observe it from the outside is very consistent with the way David has described it. I think his assessment is quite perceptive. I think this president has been struggling with this decision, and I think he has encountered what Kennedy encountered, which was a great diversity of views within his cabinet and a lack of consensus. We began this segment by Jake Tapper's report talking about the struggle to achieve this consensus within the White House and a holding of hands, if you will, between McChrystal and Eikenberry. History suggests that that is perhaps not as accurate as one would believe.
Not a genuine consensus, perhaps.
I'm
hard to square those. I have to say, having heard and read exactly what they said only days, weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of that. As David pointed out, Joe Biden was the skeptic internally within the White House, warning the president about the risks inherent in enlarging this commitment. His parallel historically was George Ball, the Undersecretary of State, who was one of the lone voices in the Johnson administration, who was a skeptic about the necessity to double down into Vietnam. The parallel between McChrystal and Eikenberry has a remarkable similarity to the tension that existed in 1965 between General Max Taylor and General William Westmoreland. At that time, Taylor, who had been Kennedy's personal military advisor and who had previously proposed an escalation in South Vietnam, sending in ground combat troops, in the summer of 65, Taylor was our U.S. ambassador to Saigon. And William Westmoreland, of course, was the theater commander. And in the winter of that year, just before the onslaught of major escalation there, it was Taylor who urged the president not to send in ground combat forces and to liberalize the rules of engagement, because he said it would breed a culture of dependence in South Vietnam. It's fascinating to me that Ambassador Eikenberry, who had been, of course, the theater commander in Afghanistan and is now our ambassador there, made almost precisely the same argument to President Obama in these cables that were reported in the media recently, arguing that we should not double down, that we should not create a culture of dependence, particularly when we had a client government in Kabul that was as dysfunctional and corrupt as it in fact is. That's precisely the problem that Kennedy confronted with President Diem and his successor, Johnson, confronted with the series of ineffective governments that followed.
That memo leaked just weeks ago from General, now Ambassador Eikenberry in Kabul. Again, to hold this against the prism of time, presidents have to decide in the end. Here's tape from May 24th, 1964. This is Lyndon Johnson, president, after the assassination of JFK, discussing his reaction to pressure to expand the war in Vietnam with his national security advisor, McGeorge Bundy. And this was secretly recorded on tape by the president, Johnson.
I'll tell you, the more I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell. It looks like me, we're getting into another Korea. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess
I ever saw. It's an awful mess.
It's an awful mess, says McGeorge Bundy, but of course he was pointing in. Let's go to our listeners, Gene in Richmond, Vermont. Gene, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm calling to make mention of this analogy between Vietnam and the war in Afghanistan. Is maybe ill-informed in that in Vietnam, we were fighting communist North Vietnam against South Vietnam, and in Afghanistan, we're fighting terrorism. This analogy is not accurate to say that there's a similarity, because in fighting terrorism, there is no country and there are no borders. And I'm not certain if Barack Obama is going to mention this tonight, in that this is our wage against terrorism. And it was mentioned that we're going to send some troops into the opium area and stop the growth of opium, which has to do with the financing of terrorism. So that's a good thing. But overall, I'd like to hear the comments of your experts on this point.
Absolutely, Gene. Thank you for your call. David Ignatius, on the one hand, yes, very different. Global terrorism has come to the United States in the late years, long since Vietnam. On the other hand, there are American troops in counterinsurgency in villages and with an enemy that comes and goes. How useful is the Vietnam analogy, whether it's the national analogy or the decision process analogy, David?
Well, I think we've discussed the decision process analogy, and that's extremely helpful and I think apposite. During the Vietnam buildup, there was a perception in the White House that we were facing a global adversary, a communist movement that was worldwide that threatened U.S. interests. And people spoke of a domino theory, that if we didn't stand tough in Vietnam, Vietnam would fall and the rest of Southeast Asia would fall, and there would be gains for this communist movement. That wasn't entirely fanciful, given that the Soviets and Chinese, although they were more split than we really understood at the time, were pushing their ideology and had a well-organized movement. Today, we face what is at least the remnants of a global jihadist movement centered around al-Qaeda, but it has many spin-offs. And you do hear the same kinds of arguments, that if we don't stand firm in Afghanistan against this movement, there will be gains in neighboring Pakistan that would have devastating effects for U.S. interests. The movement might spread north into Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, two Muslim countries that are kind of shaky politically and militarily. And so there is, again, this sense of the dominoes poised. I think one of the lessons as we look back on Vietnam is that the domino idea was overstated there, that the Vietnamese movement had its own independence even from neighboring China. It was more a civil war than a part of an international communist jihad, if you will. In the case of the Islamic movement, I do think the worries about the effect on the immediate neighbors of a Taliban success in Afghanistan are probably right. I've spent a lot of time in Pakistan this year. There's just no question that the Pakistanis are finally trying to face up to their own Taliban insurgency. They're nervous in both directions, if you will, about what we do in Afghanistan. They don't want us to leave and create a vacuum, which they think would be dangerous, but they're nervous about the products of an escalation there, too. Mm. But I think President Obama realized early in this process that just getting out of Afghanistan was not an option. He said that, you know, I think 6 weeks or so ago. And I think that's probably wise in his part, that getting out in a hurry would create a vacuum, and with all of these Islamic movements around the periphery of Afghanistan, that would be dangerous. But that's not to say that there are a whole string of dominoes and that this would roll all the way to Morocco.
Gordon, I want to hear you on that. Let me get Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts first. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I don't understand why we are, again, continuing our war. It's 8 wars since World War II. We went into Afghanistan, first of all, because of the loss of 3,000 healthy Americans on 9/11. But by now, Tom, it should be impressive upon people, the horror that we have killed more than twice that many, 7,000 now we have killed in Afghanistan. And the president should realize that that's only causing more hatred of us or more danger for further terrorism. We are seen as occupiers there. And even though we're trying to help, and God knows that country needs a lot of help in many ways, and as a woman, I see that. But I think what he could say in defense of getting out is that the terrorism around that part of the world is too vast for us to really try to work against. But we have actually accomplished something in lowering the numbers of Al-Qaeda members, and that's what Osama bin Laden came from.
So declare victory and go. It sounds like it might be your option, though it doesn't sound like what the president's proposing tonight. Jackie, thanks for your call. Gordon, you hear our callers and the questioning of the analogy Vietnam-Afghanistan, either in the field or in the Oval Office. How do you look at it? We've just got a minute before the break here, but begin for us.
Very briefly, your last caller made the point that we have a battle versus the operatives of Al-Qaeda, and that has been relatively successful. General Jones, the National Security Advisor, has said that there are less than 100 Al-Qaeda operatives now in Afghanistan. And the mission seems to have morphed now to a battle against the Taliban and defending the government in Afghanistan. So we have to be mindful of how this mission has progressed and transformed in the past 8 years. As to the question of the parallels between Vietnam and Afghanistan, David Ignatius correctly describes the parallel between global communism in the era of Vietnam and the threat of global terrorism today. That's the unifying theme for our mission in Afghanistan and previously in South Vietnam. But the parallels there are very compelling. Historically, neither country was able to be conquered by large occupying great powers. In Vietnam, China, France, Japan, and the United States could not control it. And in Afghanistan, Alexander the Great, the British, the Soviets, now the U.S. are trying to impose order. It's historically been extremely hard to dominate both of these countries.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about presidents and war and the road to President Obama's announcement tonight at West Point on Afghanistan. The Washington Post's David Ignatius is with us today, author of The Increment. Gordon Goldstein is here, scholar in international affairs, author of Lessons in Disaster, George Bundy and the Path to War in Vietnam, widely read in the White House in advance of the decision that we will all hear about tonight. Of course, some famously public disagreement between Generals McChrystal and now Ambassador Eikenberry in advance of this decision. The president's press secretary said yesterday that both men ended up pleased with the president's decision.
Both of those individuals in Afghanistan and the president felt very good about our way forward.
Maybe, maybe not. David Ignatius, what about this issue of the asserted consensus here? Do you buy it? There were some pretty tough differences of opinion on along this road, we're told.
I don't think it's quite so much consensus as it is averaging the differences, and the differences are wide. And I think that's the one thing that worries a lot of observers about this decision, that the one thing you wouldn't want to do is straddle the sharp differences of opinion with a kind of blend that didn't really give you a chance to succeed militarily but also didn't get you out. And so I think that's likely to be an area that will get a lot of examination after the president's speech. I do think that the fact that we're in effect front-loading the increase in troops, getting them in a whole lot quicker, and if things aren't working out the way proponents of the strategy argued they would, I think probably getting them back out again a lot quicker. I think that's probably the way the president's going to pitch it.
But what's the exact advantage of that? It's going to be more surgical, in and out. We'll test, and if it doesn't work, we go. Is that a reasonable approach?
The advantage, Tom, is political. You have a Democratic Party that's extremely uneasy. The Democratic House members are very uneasy with this policy, and I think the president needs to be able to say to them, this is not an open-ended commitment. I'm not walking into the big muddy. If this doesn't work out, we're not going to stay with it. I think he also probably will tell the country that the only way to the exit is by consolidating the positions that we have now, having spent a week in Afghanistan recently. I think there's some truth to that argument, that you've got to consolidate what you got before you can think about getting on the exit ramp.
Gordon, again, I want to hear you on this, but let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'd like your guest to draw another analogy that they haven't really talked about yet, and that's the analogy to Korea. If we could go back to 1952, we faced an enemy that had a support network across the national frontier. Of course, this was located in China, and some tension between General MacArthur and President Truman on how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, Truman ended up firing MacArthur when he wanted to cross the Yalu River and go after it. So strategic, you know, tension between a president and a general, similar fact pattern, although it is apples and oranges, on the ground with our situation in Pakistan and the support network there. And I'd like your guest to comment on that analogy.
We sure will. Thanks for calling, Michael. Gordon Goldstein, I mean, we heard LBJ there in the tape agonizing about another Korea as he looked at Vietnam. Now President Obama looks at Afghanistan. He has both those ghosts to contend with. Look back again with us, Gordon, and then forward to the president now and his decision.
It's a terrific question. Looking at the history as it played out in Vietnam, George Bundy, subject of my book, Lessons in Disaster, reflected on the primacy of Korea as a metaphor for what had to happen in South Vietnam. This drove Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, who was adamant about the credibility of the American commitment, and it drove a lot of the policymakers who looked at this as an analogous conflict that would end in an analogous way. They would fight to a stalemate, and then there would be some sort of an armistice, and you would preserve the independence of South Vietnam. Of course, that was a flawed strategy. You got to the stalemate, but the adversary never relented, and you were never able to coerce them into capitulating the great ambition they had to unify their country. It's fascinating, too, that General MacArthur did play a role in Kennedy's decision-making. In the summer of 1961, as Kennedy was struggling with what to do about Vietnam, and he was receiving the first of a series of proposals to send in ground combat forces there, he was ultimately advised that he would have to send in six divisions or more than 200,000 troops to defend South Vietnam. He was struggling to understand if that, in fact, was necessary and what the stakes were and what the risks were. And one of the generals he consulted was General MacArthur. And MacArthur told Kennedy, don't do it. don't fight a land war in Asia. Even if you were to send in 1 million men, you would be subsumed all around and you would not prevail. And Kennedy would often say to his advisors who made this proposal to escalate with ground combat forces, if you could persuade General MacArthur, then you can persuade me. But until you answer his questions, I'm not so sure that I'm going to be predisposed in your direction. This is one of the fascinating things about presidents and these war and peace decisions. The lessons of history bear heavily on them. Kennedy struggled with the lessons of Korea. Johnson struggled with it. When Eisenhower advised Johnson in the summer of 65 to escalate, that weighed heavily on Johnson. And obviously now President Obama is trying to understand if the proposed surge, so to speak, this major increase of 30,000 or 40,000 troops isn't going to, in fact, make the difference in Afghanistan. And tonight he's going to make his wager public.
But David Ignatius warns of the dangers anyone can see of a straddle here, pressure from generals for more troops, pressure from his own party to be careful, from his own vice president. You draw lessons from history. One is politics is the enemy of strategy. And another, conviction without rigor is a strategy for disaster. How do you apply those lessons to what you see emerging in the president's decision here, Gordon?
Well, I'm fascinated to observe the process of decision-making that David, I think, has accurately described over this past 2.5 months or so, these roughly 10 meetings of the War Cabinet. I think one of the lessons that the president has drawn from decision-making in Vietnam is he wants to be the anti-Johnson in the sense that Johnson embraced a strategy of counterinsurgency that morphed into a war of attrition recommended by General Westmoreland without ever really examining either its prospects for success or the way out. This President Obama today seems to have been mindful of that in his examination of his options. And tonight he will no doubt stress that this is not an open-ended commitment as Vietnam was, that there will be embedded into his military options an exit strategy. Yet to articulate that and to realize it are quite different things. And that, I think, is going to be the source of close examination going forward. Can he build up the Afghan security forces with sufficient speed so that they can hand this thing off within a relatively confined time frame? That's going to be ultimately the big question that everyone will be examining over the next couple of years as we watch this process unfurl.
Or does he, as you suggested earlier, having gone into the decision-making process Kennedy-esque, come out the other end Johnsonian? Daniel in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Daniel, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk about Special Forces units. I don't know if they ever realized that the more successful units in Vietnam were the LRSH units that basically were Special Forces. And President Kennedy was actually a big proponent of Special Forces, pretty much created the Green Berets or allowed them to go ahead with the Special Forces program. I think we're focusing too much on conventional when we should be focusing on bulking up our Special Forces in Afghanistan.
Daniel, are you in the military at Fort Campbell there? Are you military? And what do you think of So would you not send 30,000 more regular troops there? You do something else?
I think it's good to send more troops there, but I think they need to focus more on sending more special units over there, such as the Rangers or basically anything from Special Operations Command. I think they'd be more successful than sending in a lot more conventional ground forces. I am in the Army. I was there last year, and I noticed is that we worked with a lot of special units, but the ones who were actually seemed to be doing a more effective job were special units like the Ranger battalions and also Green Beret units over there as well.
Daniel, thanks for your call. David Ignatius, what do you make of that? I don't know what level of troops are available at the Special Forces level. When we start talking about 100,000 U.S. troops total there, is it inevitably regular forces? And what does that suggest in terms of strategy, tactics here?
There's a lot of emphasis on Special Forces and the things they can do to work with tribes, to work at the kind of decentralized, bottom-up level that many think is appropriate to Afghanistan. So General McChrystal, the overall commander, we recall, was commander of our special forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. Nobody knows that kind of warfare better than he does. The problem is you can't just crank out special forces troops. The skills, the mindset, the qualities of judgment that are necessary for these folks to be successful are unusual. And I've heard people in the military often say that you just, you know, I wish we could expand the number of special forces A teams on the ground exponentially, but we can't. That said, they're a key part of the strategy going forward. I think I would just note that although 30,000 troops is a lot of additional troops, this is not a Vietnam-style conventional approach. It really is counterinsurgency of the kind that we ended up experimenting with in Vietnam at the end of the story under General Creighton Abrams, where there was much more decentralized special forces type warfare. And so I think the notion that this is we're going to go out and search and destroy Taliban, I think that's not what's going to happen here.
But haven't we been doing both in recent months? Hasn't it been a combination of counterinsurgency and the hard hit? Hasn't that been McChrystal's formula?
Yes, the combination is what McChrystal wants. It's just the hard hits are going to be done also by special forces, so-called black special operations forces that go out and target specific units that surface because of intelligence. So I think people shouldn't have in mind a conventional war image of what these troops are going to do.
Let's get a call from Detroit, Michigan. Robert, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Chuck. What I'm thinking is that we're ignoring one of the biggest lessons that we learned from Vietnam was that the Viet Cong's Vietnamese did not want the communists, the French, or the American there. After the Americans left, they turned around and chased the communists out. They ended up fighting the war that we were supposed to protect them from fighting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Afghanistan doesn't want the Taliban or Al-Qaeda in there anymore than they want the Americans. We need to find a strategy where we can help them destroy the Taliban or the Al Qaeda, just like we did when the Russians were there. If we try to fight this war for them, we're going to end up in the same boat. It is an interesting option, special forces and all these. But if these things are sent in, they're going to end up with the same results they ended up in Vietnam.
Robert, you sound like JFK in 1963. Our time is short, but let us put it. Gordon Goldstein, to you, a caller from Detroit, says there's the ignored lesson: the U.S. troops weren't wanted, and the Vietnamese turned around ultimately. Well, of course, the communists took over, but they did. The country found a path ultimately. Isn't that kind of what the vice president was pushing here? Is this whole announcement tonight a rebuke to Joe Biden?
I don't know how this president will resolve the tensions with his vice president. Reportedly, General Jones has also been a skeptic about this. There are others in the cabinet who have. That'll be an interesting behind-the-scenes drama. But both of your callers have made a very interesting observation about special forces and the use of numbers in military strategy. It's true, Kennedy focused on much smaller numbers of special forces to execute his strategy in South Vietnam. At the time of his death, there were less than 16,000 advisors in South Vietnam, and he had a fair amount of success with his strategy. In fact, in October of 1963, he announced that the American mission in South Vietnam would be concluded by the end of 1965, and he announced the drawdown of the first 1,000 advisors from South Vietnam. There's another interesting parallel here, though, with respect to numbers. When Kennedy came to office in January of 61, he was told that Vietnam was in an emergency situation and he had to rapidly increase the number of boots on the ground in the South Vietnamese Army and American advisors. At that time, we had something like a 12-to-1 numerical advantage. He was told that it had to go to 15-to-1. Kennedy said, why can't we do more with the current numbers? With this large numerical advantage, why can't we be more effective? Today in Afghanistan, when you add American, allied, and Afghan forces, it numbers something like 250,000. The largest number of Taliban that I have seen projected in estimates from intelligence is about 20 or 25,000. We now have a 10-to-1 numerical advantage. There's an interesting question here. Why can't we do more with that numerical advantage than we are accomplishing now? And how will we achieve more by expanding that relatively by another 30,000 that gives us an 11 or 12-to-1 advantage?
The president read your book and came out with the decision that we'll hear tonight. What does that tell you about this president, Gordon?
Well, I'm extraordinarily encouraged by the character of the exercise, that the President of the United States, in the midst of making this incredible decision, amidst all of the other issues that he is struggling with, from health care on one end of the spectrum to the financial crisis and regulating the new financial architecture and so forth, that he would devote time to reflect on the lessons of history and the lessons of Vietnam, to me is an extraordinary thing. And it goes to, I think, the judicious cast of mind that this president has, his introspective and reflective qualities. And however he plays this, we know that he has been mindful of the risks, that they are present and urgent in his thinking, and that he is going to try to mitigate those risks, and that he is going to try to execute the most thoughtful decision that he can.
Mindful, but he's up against the challenge of keeping Americans on board with the war. Polls show that support slipping already, David Ignatius. That's, I suppose, at least half the challenge tonight for President Obama.
Well, I think it's more than half the challenge. Now that he has made his decision, and this is his war strategy, he has to take the country with him. And there are going to be people who will be unhappy almost about each aspect of the decision. There are people who want to get out. There are people who'd like to go in quicker. There's certainly a lot of people who wish the decision had been made sooner. The president's going to have to speak to the country and get the country with him in this strategy, and it will be a test of leadership, I think, beyond anything he's faced so far. It won't be just tonight. It'll go over the weeks and months, but he's in it now. This is now his war to convince the country makes sense.
Coming tonight from West Point, David Ignatius with The Washington Post and Gordon Goldstein, author of Lessons in Disaster. Thanks to each of you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.